This feature has been brought to you by Slot Foundation, which needs your support to continue projects like these. Information on this recording and access to other recordings is available online at slot.org.
I've done different kinds of work around prison issues for a long time, radio work, art projects. One of my collaborators, Eric Ruin, is here today. I've done work in Philadelphia with him, and academic work, activist work, and have been thinking about, you know, what it would mean or how to think about moving images in relation to the prison system for a long time. And, you know, the conceit of the project sort of comes out of a kind of methodological problem that I think of as also a political problem, which is that prisons are, by definition, in a way, spaces of disappearance, right? They're sort of designed to disappear people or try to disappear people, remove them from their lives, remove them from their communities, from their families, take state punishment out of the public sphere and hide it behind walls. And over time, you know, and as the prison system has grown, that's, I think, been even more true. So, you know, it used to be, you know, in places like Philadelphia that prisons were built in cities. So even though punishment was happening behind walls, there was still the prison itself was still there to be visible and to terrorize people, really. And you know, in the sort of era of mass incarceration, prisons themselves are increasingly relegated to really remote landscapes far away from where people live and designed to not be encountered. They're really hard to access, really hard to get inside. And that, you know, I think is a political problem. It's also obviously a supposed problem if you're a person who works in images. How do you make images of the prison system if you can't get access? And I wanted to kind of turn that on its head and think about, you know, that supposed problem of access as an opportunity to kind of turn the gaze elsewhere, and by turning the gaze elsewhere suggest that we actually do well to think about prisons outside of the sort of narrow confines of the criminal justice system or you know, crime and punishment, and really think about how prisons relate to other aspects of the social order, you know, the labor market, real estate, the political system, and so on. And so that's sort of how the conceit of the project came to be.
Great. I think, yeah, I'm definitely going to open this up to questions. I want to give Jim Baker a chance also to say a few words and introduce his perspective in it, and then we'll definitely be doing a lot of questions. Thanks, Brad.
Well, again, I thank you for having me. A little bit more to my narrative, I was locked in a bathroom for almost 20 years, about 18 years. And during that time, I didn't realize that I had suffered from PTSD and other mental health issues that I thought by design they were attributed to when I was in the Air Force and I babysat nuclear weapons 800 feet underground in a confined situation. But it went further than that. That what the film had placed emphasis on, that it's a diabolical scheme to not just to isolate you away from family, friends, loved ones, but to not just the thing where they just separate you and warehouse you. Because slowly and gradually they take things like education, recreation, and things that just play on your mental. And so not only do they isolate you and warehouse you, but they mothball you, where they have you stagnant in your decision making and things that come natural as far as family interactions and social skills that you have to almost invert or turn upside down your whole social value system, where you don't trust much of anything and you really isolate yourself once you come home after you do a substantial amount of time. I've been blessed and fortunate to get in touch with some things that not only are like-minded as far as forward thinking, because up top my strengths was the juvenile lifers that's coming home now. They were the things that were inspirational, motivational. These guys, although they had life, they had figured it out. They figured out how to make every day mean something, and they convinced you, especially those of us that were going home eventually, that we can sort of live life for them. They would actually live vicariously through our experiences as we kept in touch with them. And even when we didn't touch base with them, they would hear about things that we were doing that made us not just survive but become successful. It was the very things that helped me in my mental health issues. I've been fortunate again that my mentor is the director of the agency that I'm representing, the Carceral Community Center. And so I'm really anxious to hear what your questions are, what your comments are.
I think, is this on?
Yeah.
This doesn't do well with long hair. I think what was really interesting to me when I was watching the movie was, watching the documentary, was the constant juxtaposition of the everyday with the spectacular. So the everyday experience of being surveilled, of being ticketed for trash can lids, of standing in line for hours, juxtaposed, of course, with the spectacular stuff that has happened in recent months and years, with Ferguson, et cetera, and Baltimore and Philadelphia. And it also is kind of what you said, Brett, about it being invisible. To an extent, yes, prisons are invisible to the rest of the world, but unfortunately to the community that is being targeted, communities that Jim, for example, is a member of, that's almost hyper-visible. Again, almost mundane, because almost everybody does time. And how does this work in the way you've, you know, kind of portrayed this, the form of it, you know? It goes from seriously chilling music and photography at the rallies to the real, you know, the mundane, the constant surveillance. How did that play out when you were actually filming it?
Yeah. You know, I was thinking a lot about, you know, as much as what I said earlier stands, that there's ways in which we're, some of us are supposed not to see the prison system and its consequences. You know, we're also set, you know, seeing images of prison life all the time in the media, and there's a kind of sensationalism to a lot of those images. And even the, you know, it, to my mind, a lot of documentaries that are have a kind of progressive intention in some ways end up reproducing sort of some of the mythologies on which prisons hang, right? One of the main ones being that prisons are the kind of are the consequence of criminal behavior. And I really wanted to make a film that in some ways, you know, is about prisons and not at all about crime. That if it's about crime at all, it's to put crime in quotation marks and to ask us how do we, you know, how did we, how and when do we deploy that term? What does it do? But also to think about, and I think it's hard, you know, to think about how to represent systems and institutions, precisely because they're so banal, because they're part of sort of the infrastructure of everyday life. And yeah, I wanted to try and think about what it would mean to use sound and images and conversations with people to portray a system that's sprawling and banal, you know, as banal as you know, a municipal revenue scheme. You know, how does a tiny town of, you know, 300 people pay its garbage collectors? Well, it floods the highway with police officers who stop and harass poor, mainly African American residents. So there's a slow violence there that is every much as, you know, part and parcel of the effects of the prison system that I think don't get attended to, especially I think for a lot of the caregivers, people who, you know, the women, the mothers, the girlfriends and daughters who take buses, and there's the slow violence, as you said, of waiting in line, of taking a bus, of 12 hours later being turned around because you're not wearing the right shirt. That's really part of the extensive damage that gets done every day.
Jim, you know, you've been released into, after years, decades, you were released into Philadelphia, the community of Philadelphia, and we are the most incarcerated city, big city in the world in history. The rates here are stupendous. I do always want to talk about those numbers because they almost become unbelievable in the context of what you see in an amazing documentary like this. The US has incarcerated more people than any other country in the history of humanity, and the US rates are around 324 per 100,000. In Philadelphia, the jail rates are 728 per 100,000. That's more than double. If you're for African Americans, the rates go up to 1,200 per 100,000. If you're an African American male between the ages of 18 to 24, that's way beyond. The denominator doesn't even 100,000 doesn't make sense. One in every four gets imprisoned. You are directly in this community right now, and you are doing incredible mentor work with the Center for Carceral Communities, where you and I are colleagues, and for the Reentry Coalition. What's it feel like to be released into this cauldron? You know, this storm of reentry as well as incarceration, and to watch something like this. Well, can you?
It is a little weird because frightening too. Like when I'm not in front of, you know, people that have a sense of compassion, I'm around people on the opposite end of the spectrum who scrutinize and look at every move I make and try to associate or affiliate it with the criminal mind. So it's hard to do the dance at times, especially for me, that I didn't realize that mental health issues were even developed, you know, sitting in that bathroom for them periods of time with different cellies, with different mindsets, and even the prison guards who would, a lot of times they were like the evil zookeepers that, you know, kept gnawing at you, kept messing with your psyche, that some of that stuff you carry unconsciously, you know, just dealing with everyday life, just looking. So it's been hard to navigate, but again, because I'm in rooms like this and around people like you, that I'm able to better navigate and maintain a sense of civility, not necessarily believing that I'm a success. You know, I like hearing it, but I haven't been convinced of it because I, you know, been convinced otherwise. So it's hard to shake that and to be able to move every day. And now I am excited about getting up, like some of the challenges, like right now is finals, and I love that anxiety, that thing charges me, and especially when, you know, you come out on the other end smelling like a rose, 3.8 GPA. So those things give me a sense of accomplishment and achievement, but again, society is hard. I've been thrust into this advocacy thing, so I've become an activist by default, more or less, you know, because I had so many obstacles, so many eggshells that I had to walk on. And, you know, others like yourself has convinced me that I could probably be a mouthpiece.
Let me ask this of the audience, of all of us, and I think it's a moment in time in Philadelphia, right? We have Larry Krasner. He's the guy who keeps many of us out of jail when we protest, but now he's the new DA, right? We have a transition moment from an old regime to the new regime. We have a moment when a lot of the world is watching Philadelphia, right? In terms of moving forward, what are the pitfalls of this? I'm a social worker by training, right? And I always worry about becoming part of a management scheme. What I mean by that is, well, it's the buzzword. Reentry is the buzzword. It's a moment that is both politically important, but also it can become part of something of this liberal ethos of wanting to do something but not really getting it done because there's a lot of programs there. There's a lot of initiatives there. How do we, you know, taking some of the lessons of mundane, everyday surveillance that happens in our communities and then the spectacular angers that hit, how do we kind of go from management to actual change around the concept of incarceration? Yes, exactly. I wonder if you can start us off and if there are any responses from the audience too.
Well, I think that's really important. That's key right now. I'm not totally sold on Larry Krasner, so I'm glad you gave me permission to speak candidly and honestly and brutally honest at that. But I am anxious to see what decarceration looks like from somebody else's eyes. I know what it looks like from my eyes. Like, you should revamp this whole system. Not only you should go behind them walls and re-examine some of these guys' security level as well as their crimes, but you should also, when they come out, have some kind of incentive-based initiative, because the fines and restitutions that they have us paying back is crazy astronomical. So why not, because you're not going to give us good time behind bars, give us great time on this side of the wall and reduce some of those rates, for lack of better terms, if we do well enough, like you're proud or you think that I'm a success, then, you know, change some of those numbers. Because right now, I can't even afford to take care of me and a mother who right now I'm taking care of with hospice. She has cancer, but her faith is through the roof, and she's convinced me to keep doing what I'm doing. But how do we think that decarceration should look? And what are some suggestions to, again, to keep us on path? I know what does it for me is, like I said, education is my key. That's the thing that not only motivates me, it moves me, it challenges me, and it helps me able to plot my progression.
Brett, you've done a lot of research for this nationally too. What do you think, what are the pitfalls moving forward?
Well, I mean, there's lots of pitfalls. I just want to say that, you know, I have, yes, done a lot of research, but also learned, everything from people on the inside and people on the outside who do organizing work, not just, you know, for prisoner justice, for prison abolition, but also healthcare and housing. And I come to doing work around prisons from a anti-poverty activist history. And I think that, you know, I've learned so many things from activists on the ground, but a sort of central lesson when it comes to thinking about decarceration is that prison abolition is about transforming the kinds of relationships that produce prisons in the first place. And a lot, those relationships are capitalist relationships, they're racist relationships. And most prisons in this country, most jails in this country are public, which means we pay for them. And the politics of decarceration, I think, means demanding that money back, you know, demanding that money back and putting it somewhere else. So I think the on-the-ground work to close actual prisons is really important, actual jails, not getting them built in the first place and therefore not getting filled, but also the work of demanding that state resources that would otherwise be paying police get used to be, you know, to put into healthcare and schools and housing. That's a prison abolitionist politics.
And ask you, Jim, you know, one of the things that's reflected from, I mean, that's kind of an extension of what I call the mundane surveillance that you show, is reflected in the fact that in Philadelphia, we have the highest population of probation and parole. And that kind of constant checking that happens on a weekly basis. You gotta pee for them. You gotta show up for them. You gotta, I mean, they're in up your, you know what. And that's the, it's the biggest pipeline in this city back into prison, in fact. But we don't actually go to the streets for that. We go to the streets for the police, which is a problem. But I don't see folks going to the streets for what we know is the major problem in our lives in Philadelphia, which is probation and parole, and the terrible ways that they surveil people. Because those people are part of the community. They are literally the people next door. I'm wondering, because probation and parole hires from the community, and that's how it works. So I'm wondering what your thoughts are about, you know, how do we, if we want to concretize change, and we know that's one of the things we want to move towards in a community like Philadelphia, You've been doing this for a few years now. What do you think are the next steps with that?
Well, sensitivity training won't work. It's just like with the police officers, there's convince themselves that they have to protect and maintain safety. But I believe that it should be under a little bit more scrutiny, that they, since we have to jump through so many loops, I think that their hoops should be as many. That the bar is definitely lowered, and it seems like it's getting worse. And because this system is so crazy, I've had 3 different parole agents in the last 8 months, and each one doesn't know anything about the rapport or the respect that I had with the one prior to. Now, I've been an expert at establishing rapport. 17 years locked in the bathroom, you find ways to not only have Gandhi patience, but you find a way to Jedi mind trick some of those guards to, you know, get certain graces and liberties. So I've figured out how to, you know, navigate, but you got men that are told that they have to pay these astronomical restitutions and fines, that they have to find employment, and they have to maintain steady housing. So if you can't do one of those three, your whole ecosystem is foiled. So I believe that, again, that these agents should be sensitive to those things, that they should be made aware of your progress and your regress in maintaining housing, getting gainful employment, and especially those of us that want to pursue educational.
Brett, any thoughts on that? Because you saw a lot of that in even in the documentary about, you know, people, the everyday lives and how they kind of build up to these moments of, yeah, of no moreness. So
I mean, I was actually just going to respond to that comment. You know, and I don't know the sort of in and outs of the victory for Larry Krasner, but it seems like it's maybe a qualified win, but a win nonetheless for grassroots social justice activists. And I in general feel like we need to celebrate our wins, that wins are an opportunity to know our own power and to build on that power to gain even more. And I, you know, there's a reason that the film ends with Attica. And it's not just because I wanted the film to end with a prison as a reminder that at the same, you know, as much as these other landscapes are also caught up in the prison system, there are also these buildings where people are today at this moment locked up in bathrooms. But it was an homage to the prisoners who struggled and who are today struggling. And, you know, that in Attica in 1971, that was an incredible moment for prisoner activism, where people on the outside, we think a lot about people on the outside who are part of the civil rights movement and radical movements, and they in many contexts were taking their cues from people on the inside who had an analysis of capitalism and imperialism and an anti-racist politics. And I just think, you know, we need to be realistic about state oppression, but we should also celebrate our capacity to fight and win.